Welcome to the Conversations Politics podcast from Canberra. I'm Michelle Grattan. Tony Abbott has said he wants to be known as the Infrastructure Prime Minister. And the government's first months have been marked by infrastructure announcements. For example, a second airport for Sydney together with supporting construction, and a scheme to encourage the states to sell off assets and devote the money to new infrastructure projects. Jamie Briggs is Assistant Minister for Infrastructure and Regional Development, and he joins us today. In a previous life, he was an advisor in John Howard's Prime Ministerial Office. Jamie Briggs, before we get on to infrastructure, tell us all what it was like to make that jump from political advisor to politician and now to minister.
Well, thanks for speaking with me, Michelle. Well, it's a each role is substantially different. I think in the government of the country, obviously working for a prime minister is a hugely significant opportunity, and working for John Howard particularly was an enormously beneficial training ground, if I can put it that way. He was and still is a very wise person to speak to about politics and to learn the art of public policy and politics.
You keep in touch?
We keep in touch. Yeah, I keep in touch quite regularly. He has been at home recently for dinner when he was in Adelaide. We have a very warm relationship.
He's the advisor now.
for want of a better term, a mentor, I guess. I think he's someone who understands the interaction of politics and policy better than anyone. I think that we've seen, certainly that I've seen in politics. And that is really the art. Ultimately, you have to be in a position to be able to win elections to be in government, but you have to be in government in a position to put in place good policy. And the two must meet at some point. Not always will some policy be popular politics, but it'll be good politics if you stick with it. And I think John Howard, made lots of mistakes in his career, but he made what he did do was learn from those mistakes. And I think what I've tried to do is take that lesson, particularly that you won't always get everything right, you won't always get every radio interview right or interview with a reporter right or decision right for that matter, but if you can learn and improve constantly, then you'll get better as time goes on.
There's been a lot of debate in recent years about staffers going on to be politicians, and some people say there are too many of them on both sides of politics have been down that road. But do you think being a staffer is in fact good training for being a politician?
I think there's different levels of being a staffer, if I can put it that way. I think there's a difference between being an elected officer, jumping straight into being an MP with little other experience, and working in a senior role for a prime minister or for a senior minister. I think that exposes you to a whole range of other issues, and of course, it's inevitable that if you've worked in politics, you've got an interest in politics, and some of those people have got an interest enough to want to run for politics. John Howard himself used to carry the bags of a former prime minister around for a little while. He doesn't admit it readily, but he did.
Well, that was Billy McMahon,
indeed,
and it ended in tears.
It did. Alexander Downer, who I replaced obviously in Mayo, he was a staff member to a prime minister as well. It does give you a great exposure and an understanding, I think, about how Canberra works, about, how to deal, I think, and develop relationships. Some of the relationships I have with press gallery journalist Michelle was from prior to entering Parliament. So obviously some of those things are beneficial. I think the point that John Howard always made was that you want a vast range of experience in your party room, and I think that's what we've got. But you do see, I think, in the senior roles in government, inevitably people who have been around politics for some time. That is, if nothing else, I think the lesson of the last few years is that you can't buy experience in politics. You've got to be around for some time. You've got to take some hits. You've got to learn some lessons.
Well, indeed, just talking about hits, you were an advisor on industrial relations during the period of work choices, that must have been a lesson in rugged politics.
It was, yeah, indeed. I mean, it was an intense time working for a prime minister, firstly, but certainly on an issue which was difficult politically and difficult in a policy sense too. It was a very complicated policy area. And, you know, we undoubtedly made mistakes in that process. But one thing I certainly learned, and I think my staff would testify to, is that what I learned from John Howard is that there is only one politician in a political office. The moment you allow your staff to become their own actors, and I think Kevin Rudd made this mistake, as soon as your staff become players themselves, it's a big mistake. There can only be one person who ultimately makes decisions and argues those decisions, and that is, I think, one of the great lessons that John Howard taught, and why his office was so successfully run.
Now let's turn to your infrastructure job, your mm-hmm. present job. How does Australia compare in terms of infrastructure with comparable countries like Canada, mm-hmm. United States, New Zealand on a smaller scale? We hear a lot about the fact that we need to pull up our socks, but if you were doing a stock take across nations, where are we?
Well, that's a good question. The Canadians have a different system to the extent where their industry super funds or their pension funds particularly are quite rich, for want of a better term, and they invest pretty heavily in Canadian assets. The Americans have a lot of priced roads. They have also got some pretty creaky infrastructure, because you'd remember post the Second World War there was a large emphasis on building freeways and so forth, and a lot of those freeways now are in dire need of maintenance. And one of the issues with the Americans not having any money is that the maintenance budget is something that gets cut. That is consistent across countries. New Zealand has quite an interesting system in the sense that because they've only got two levels of government, it makes it a lot easier. One of the complications in Australia is the three levels of government. A vast majority of our roads, most people wouldn't realise this, but a vast majority of our roads are owned and operated by local government. Then there are substantial parts of our freight network run by the state government. And what the federal government does is give money to both levels to maintain and build new and update existing infrastructure. Whereas in New Zealand, they're able to have a much flatter structure between the two levels of government, which certainly has some benefits. And the Productivity Commission, the draft report, talks about that. What we've tried to do, and to give Anthony Albanese some credit here, he put in place Infrastructure Australia, and I think it was a good reform. And clearly what we're trying to do is strengthen the capacity of Infrastructure Australia to be able to be more involved in making decisions based on economic need rather than other factors, which can sometimes influence infrastructure decisions. That's not always going to be perfect, because the economic case for a road in a regional area is most often going to be less compelling than in urban areas, but of course there are benefits to investing in roads in our regional areas as well. So there's a balance that we need to work through, but we've put that line at 100 million, and projects of above $100 million will go through Infrastructure Australia. And we need, as a government, to then justify decisions in investments when we've made those decisions.
What would you say were the main shortfalls at the moment? Is it in roads or is it in rail? Or
yeah, the draft Productivity Commission report's pretty compelling, I think, about the way we're making decisions on infrastructure and the way we allocate funding and the way that we then pursue those projects. It depends again on what you're looking to do. If you're looking to move people around cities, then the state governments are trying to catch up a bit on public transport systems, and you've seen Gladys Berejiklian do some great work as the rail minister, in effect, in New South Wales, and investing in new railway lines, which hadn't happened for a long time. But the problem with rail in Australia, of course, is it's never economic. We don't have the scale, and therefore it's always a loss-making exercise, and the state governments have got to be careful in that sense. Dennis Napthine's just announced a commitment to the Melbourne Metro, a long-term commitment, equally But there are obviously major congestion issues which we're seeking to address through projects like the WestConnex project in Sydney, the East-West project in Melbourne, and there'll be a vast other amount of projects that we'll be talking about in the budget that we're seeking to address, because we see infrastructure as a particularly important way to build the framework for our economy to operate efficiently. You know, we've made pretty clear that we're not interested in funding particular businesses or the taxpayer funding particular businesses, but what we do see the role of the federal government doing is to ensure that there are the transport networks, the infrastructure networks, or the framework is there so all businesses can compete equally. And that's why we'll be investing very heavily in the budget on our infrastructure framework.
And obviously you're not going to go into budget secrets, but there will be new announcements in the budget on infrastructure.
There
not
will
just
be substantially new announcements in the budget
and
on
new
infrastructure.
Money?
And new money.
Right. Mm. So savings come from your area or someone else's area?
Well, look, there's multiple parts of our portfolio, and there is each portfolio minister has had to take substantial decisions which will be very difficult for some people to accept, I think. But what we've been very clear about is that we want to live within our means and have a faster growing economy, and we believe that infrastructure investment is a way to help get that economy moving better and more efficiently and quicker, and that's been a commitment we made prior to the election. The budget will outline a very comprehensive infrastructure plan, building on what is already in the budget, which is $36 billion already. We've already announced last week the plan in Western Sydney, which is substantial. It's $1.3 billion over the Ford estimates. It's $3.5 billion with New South Wales over 10 years. And it's designed to make the most of that part of our country, 2 million people. We want it to grow quicker than what it is. And equally, with our major cities across the country, there'll be similar type of announcements in the budget.
Just taking the Badgerys Creek announcement, it is going to be a long time before anybody actually flies in or out of that airport.
Yeah.
It's a decade, is that about the time frame?
Well, look, I'd hope it's sooner than that. I think that's a conservative estimate. I think you'll find that the Badgerys Creek, well, the Western Sydney Airport will be a startling success when it gets up and running.
Why does it take so long?
Well, that is a good question. That's a question that we are trying to work our way through. And we, you know, we don't want it to take that long. The first thing in respect of the airport is that when the airports were sold some time ago, there was a provision put in the contract, which of course meant that there was a premium paid, that the owners of the Sydney Airport had the first right to build any new, when there was a decision to build a second airport in Western Sydney. So they now have a process and a time period where they can go through negotiating with the federal government on whether they want to take that up or not, and that can go for 2 years. Now, the reality is it would be very surprising if they didn't take up that option. But obviously,
well, especially as Maxwell Wilton, who of course was head of Prime Ministers under John Howard, is chief of Sydney Airport, and I think he'd be an expansionist, wouldn't he? Mm-hmm.
Well, look, Max has said many things about a potential second Sydney Airport, but now the decision's made, I think the commercial interests of his company, of course, will come to the fore, as they should, and they will negotiate on that basis.
Is that a good sort of structure, though? Wouldn't it be better to have a different operator to get a bit more contestability?
Well, look, that's a good point, but it's the structure we've got. And if they don't come to terms, it must be said, after the two-year period, then that indeed will be what happens. There'll be an opportunity for another player to be part of it. That will, of course, delay the project, but there would be that contestability element. I don't see that happening. I think we'll come to terms, and the Deputy Prime Minister is leading these negotiations. We'll come to terms reasonably quickly, and we'll get underway reasonably quickly. But when that decision's made, we'll do what we have to do to ensure that all the approvals are put in place as quickly as possible. People have have the right to have an opportunity to express their view, to provide feedback and ask for things to be amended where there is reasonable cases for that. But we're not going to get ourselves into a situation where we're just forever having projects delayed because someone doesn't want it, or a group of people have decided they're going to try and stop it no matter what. governments have got to make decisions and they've got to back those decisions up to the full force of their legislative potential.
Airports, of course, usually come with political pain, arguments about noise and so on. Do you think that'll be a big factor this time, or do you think it's isolated enough to minimise the political problems?
Well, I spent 3 days out in Western Sydney last week around the announcement, and I'll spend more time out there next week. Again, the feedback that my colleagues received early on, and I certainly received at the first forum we had on Thursday morning, was very positive, saying that there'll be people opposed to it. There'll be people concerned about it. There are already. And I think people are right to have reasonable questions that they want to ask from time to time. But I think the fact that this has been around for 30 years and we've seen this debate on any number of occasions, I suspect has prepared the groundwork a lot better than just an announcement out of the blue. I think people have seen this coming for a while, and I think there's quite a number of people, certainly out in Western Sydney, that I spoke to last week and heard on Talkback Radio or gone through my colleagues' offices, who want this happening now, who want cranes above the site now. You know, you've got to remember, if you live in Penrith, which is a substantial city in its own right now, it takes you an hour and a half to get to Kingsford Smith Airport. That's a big chunk if you want to travel somewhere. So for people, you know, 2 million people live in that part of the world. We talk about them often in the Western Sydney sense. There is a very good case to have an airport, which I think will grow very quickly when it gets underway.
Now, years ago, of course, Australian governments built and owned key infrastructure, especially state governments. Now there's much more reliance on the private sector. How do you see this public-private divide?
That's a very good question. You will always need the federal and state government to be involved, and local government for that matter, to be involved in the maintaining and building of certain infrastructure. You have to fund it somehow. At the moment, we fund... arguably, not always happens, but arguably by petrol taxes and registrations are largely what allocated to funding our road networks. I think the Productivity Commission said about $19 billion in revenue was taken each year from those revenue sources in addition to tolling and so forth, and there's about $18 billion spent on roads maintenance and new roads. There is a reasonable argument about how we collect and how we divide up the amount of money that we're taking to ensure we're getting the money allocated to the right spots in the network. And equally, we will have to increasingly look at the private sector being involved in new big projects like the WestConnex project in Sydney, where you have to go underground, for instance. East-West is the same in Melbourne. And that's just purely the numbers associated with these projects, because you're going underground, are so large that you'll need a private sector involvement. They've gone past the capacity of government to deliver on their own. And I think people will accept that if they see a genuine improvement in their travel time and the efficiency of the road network. So it will be a mixture of public investment, public and private investment, and in some cases the private sector leading the way where it's appropriate. The NorthConnex project in Sydney is a good example of that, where the private sector is leading the way, went to government with a proposal. It's a road that wouldn't have happened otherwise.
So the whole user pays principle is one that we're going to increasingly see in the infrastructure area, do you think?
Well, we have user pays now. We're just a bit blind to it in a lot of ways. We're blind to it in the sense that every time we fill up our car, we're user paying to use a road network. Every time we pay a registration fee.
I mean, directly.
I think there's a reasonable argument about it, and there's a reasonable debate. We're about to trial a heavy vehicle charging mechanism, which is different, taking away the excise and putting in a heavy vehicle by kilometre charging regime, which is will hopefully tick off mid-year with the states. And that, I think, will be an interesting trial to see whether we can pull it off. And if you can master that, then you can look in the future at how are you going to operate your road network. If you can get the same amount and even less and collect it more efficiently, that's a better system than what we've got.
The Productivity Commission was quite scathing about the problems of project evaluation, and a lot of the difficulties were at the first stage, as it were, of looking at particular projects. What are you going to do in the short term to try and improve all that?
well, the Infrastructure Australia plays a really important role in this. We have a finite amount of taxpayers' money, and the states have a finite amount of their money, and so does local government. We've got to get to a system where we're making much better judgments about projects based on the economic benefit, and that is really resting in the first instance with the states doing the preparatory work. It's a big problem that we've got, and it's horse and cart. It's very difficult to work out an easy solution. We don't have ready-to-go plans sitting in the drawers of state transport ministers. We have ideas about what we should do in the future, and you know, each state or each city has a master plan. But where you've got a indication where you might put a new road, or you might expand a current road, there's not actual plans that you can grab and then take and get into straight away. But this, and equally, the states say, well, if we do that, we're spending precious infrastructure money on plans which may never come to pass. So it isn't an easy problem to solve, but we think if you have this 15-year pipeline where you've got the states to work out a priority list, where you start to do early planning work and so forth, one, you'll send a signal to the private sector, there's a bunch of projects here that you might want to get involved in, but two, you'll be able to move more quickly when there are opportunities in a budget where you might want to have a growth package, like we'll be doing in this federal budget, where you can guarantee early movement. Many of these projects you can announce, but you don't get moving on them for 18 months because by the time the approval processes and so forth happen, it takes some time. So it's not an easy thing to solve, a challenge to solve, but I think what we want to do is really put in place a much more sort of comprehensive, longer-term look at what do we think the next 15 years is going to look like based on what Infrastructure Australia agrees are decent business cost evaluations.
And while you're trying to cut red tape in many cases, there are also problems on the other side of that, aren't there, that you can have too little regulation, which comes back to bite you somewhere down the track.
It is a balance. I think it gets to making sure you've got time certainty with some of these approvals and so forth. And you're seeing in Victoria, for instance, with the East West project, where the state governments move specific legislation for that the planning approval stages, where people have got the opportunity to express their views, make their views known about the plans, ask for change, but with a set date on when a decision is going to be made to give the certainty to get on with it. And I think that's a model that the Prime Minister is certainly attracted to. You need a mixture of opportunity for community to express their view, but at the same time getting
an end to it all.
Exactly, getting some set time frames so people don't say, well, this was announced 2 years ago, what's happening here?
More generally, talking about economic policy, you've been one of the hardline economic dries over quite a period in the Liberal Party. Were you surprised at how dry Tony Abbott turned out to be on things like industry policy?
Well, look, I think the reality of the situation has mugged us all. It's no secret that there are many of us in the Liberal Party who have for some time questioned the benefit to our society of one taxpayer paying more tax to fund another taxpayer's business, or indeed an internationally owned and operated business. But some of these changes which have been coming down the line through economic change, which was started by John Button and Paul Keating and Bob Hawke in the 1980s, are really starting to squeeze certain parts of our economy. And that's very obvious, particularly in my home state of Adelaide, of South Australia, and Melbourne and Victoria are seeing probably the hardest edge of this, or have seen the hardest edge of this. The reality is, no matter what the political puffery around it, no matter who was in government last December, General Motors was going to decide to shut their holding operations in Australia. And the outcome of that, of course, was that Toyota would follow suit because it became impossible for them to run their operations. So in fairness to the Prime Minister, we had little choice. There were no other options. I think in respect to the SPC decision, what that indicated, and as you know, Michelle, governments you know, in the end, are judged by their actions. And what that action showed was the direction that the PM wants his government to be shown to be taking. And that is, we will, you know, cut red tape. We will build infrastructure. We will look to reduce taxes. And we'll give every business a chance. But we're not going to fund one over another, because we think that that is a short-term and flawed way to run an economy, and it's been proven so.
One of the problems for governments, for politicians generally these days, is selling the economic message, isn't it? Because they've sort of trashed themselves so much that people are cynical about them, turn off these conversations. Perhaps one of the successes of the Labor government in the 80s was in fact selling the economic message, because people weren't quite so disillusioned in those days.
Whether it's disillusioned or whether you need a voice for the message, I think a mistake was probably made by a combination of factors. You're dead right. Hawke and Keating took on difficult reform, which affected their support base very heavily, but they argued the case because they believed in the case, and they were right. And, you know, thank goodness that they were brave, because our country is a lot better for it. We all know that. Some people don't accept it, but the reality is that we are better off because of it. Howard and Costello continued it and accelerated certain aspects of it, taxation reform, workplace relations reform, and again, our country improved because of it. And we took advantage. I mean, people forget this. The reason we were able to take advantage of the sudden growth in China, the, you know, unexpected to a degree growth in China in the 2000s, was because our economy was prepared to take advantage of that growth. Our economy was equally prepared to take the shocks when the global financial crisis hit because of that 20 years of reform that those governments had entered into. But what they both did, both of those governments, I think, is argued their case to the community, whether it was popular or not. Peter Reith argued waterfront reform. It was never popular. It was very, very few people supported it, but it was absolutely worthwhile reform. Howard and Costello took the GST to an election. Keating and Hawke did similar things. For the last 6 or 7 years, we haven't had an advocate for economic change and why economic change is necessary, and why freer trade is good, and why ensuring that we, you know, live within our means, and we have an economy which is not held back by unnecessary regulation, is good for all of us. If you don't have an advocate, the people who are opposed to it, who will always exist in a democracy, will of course win the day.
Do you think that one of the reasons that Clive Palmer, who is particularly vocal at the moment, has got the support he has, is because people have become disillusioned with the political process or turned off the debates?
Look, I don't think so. I think if you look back the early stages of the Howard government, we had Pauline Hanson fill that space in the electoral map, if for want of a better term. You've had groups always in the Australian political history which have filled that sort of third, fourth party or that space in our map, particularly where they've got an influence in the Senate. They become very interesting to journalists. The day-to-day business of preparing for a budget becomes boring until the budget comes out. People who will play a role in the Senate obviously are interesting, but I don't think people should get too caught up on the day-to-day commentary.
Do you think the government will be able to deal with Clive Palmer all right? Because he's got not just a presence, but he has real power through his Senate numbers.
Oh, and so does Nick Xenophon, and so does Bob Day, and so does...
But he has more.
Well, at the end of the day, most of what you move in a budget, the Labor Party will support. That is the tradition, of course. They'll allow the budget bills through Parliament. That would be historic if they didn't. There will be hot spots, no doubt, with certain senators. I'm sure there'll be some issues on our own side that certain senators will express displeasure potentially with, because at the end of the day, every senator becomes powerful in that sort of scenario. But
well, at least Barnaby Joyce is in the lower house these days and a minister.
Doing a terrific job as agriculture minister. But I think the reality is, every senator knows, as every House of Representative member knows, that the last thing anyone wants is for us to return to the ballot box in a real hurry. And if I think people are seen as wreckers of a government agenda, they're never dealt with nicely by the electorate. So I don't, you know, there'll be a lot of commentary, there'll be a lot of chest banging in the next few weeks, particularly up to the budget and after the budget.
But never ever a double dissolution?
I would be very surprised if we wanted to go down to a double dissolution. It would be, I think, if the carbon tax particularly, which was obviously the key commitment that Tony Abbott had made to the electorate, was held up unnecessarily. That would be the only circumstance that I can imagine that we'd look to a DD.
Now, just finally, you share a house in Canberra with Treasurer Joe Hockey. I'm just wondering, is the budget dominating the breakfast table discussion?
Well, he's kicked me out on budget night because he's got all his family here and so forth. So I'm homeless on budget night because of it. But look, he's extremely focused. And
bit grumpy at breakfast?
No, he's not. I think he's steeled by the responsibility. And we've had some time to think about it, I think. You know, we've talked about this stuff for a while now. We're right at the hard point of all his decision making. These days are the when the budget really gets locked down, as you know. So I think he knows the task. We know that the task is difficult, but we're all confident, I think, if we put to the Australian people a case which is that this is part of a broader economic plan, that in the end people will support that, and you know that'll make our breakfasts easier to deal with the headlines that will inevitably appear.
Well, Jamie Briggs, good luck with searching for a bit of temporary accommodation. And that's all for the Conversations Politics podcast today. Thank you to my producer Matt Dawson. We'll be back with another guest very soon.